We had a really good response from the first round of this, and looking forward to this one. We've had also some really great questions. In fact, with both of these sessions, we've had more questions than we could possibly answer on the show. There may be other opportunities to address these, but we'll take up as many as we can. The first question I want to talk about comes from Mark Jenkins from Los Angeles. And Mark says, hi, I live in Los Angeles and would like to pursue chair making, but the lumber available here is all kiln dried. Air dried isn't available, let alone green log. So I ran into that issue and for years taught chair making in both the Hawthorne, Orange, Los Angeles, all around Southern California, and this was always a problem, and in Portland, Oregon as well. There's several ways that people have addressed this. One is to buy kiln-dried lumber, saw the parts out, get things ready to steam bin, and actually steam the kiln-dried lumber for about an hour, let it sit in the steamer overnight, and then the next day soak it or just re-steam it again. But if you soak it, you'll still have to steam it again. So that's a way to sort of anneal or reconstitute lumber that's kiln dried. It's an expensive kind of pain in the butt way to deal with it. But we also supply wood to, and have for years, supplied wood to chair makers. So if you want to call us and let us know what your needs are, we'll have a minimum order. But that's one way to do it. But green wood, it doesn't have really advantages unless you have really good access to standing timber. If you're having to pay for reconstituting wood or having wood shipped out one chair at a time, being able to manage green wood chair making processes so that they work like they originally did, it's just not worth it. There are other ways to take advantage of wood moisture and bending, partly by the way that I was just talking about, but it's more important that in greenwood chair making that the male parts are super dried, and that's a lot easier to do out your way. So, having a direct source back here like us or Robert Karen, which you can contact through us, it is probably the simplest way to do it. We can not only get you air dried and green stock, but stock that's specifically selected for this kind of work. One of the things that has made a difference in the way that I work since I started is being close to the timber and being able to work directly from the log. Whether I'm making a table that's going to be, kiln-dried material at some point, having access to the log and being able to decide exactly how that material comes out of the log, how I saw it, the dimensions I saw it to, and exactly how it's dried have a whole lot to do with how enjoyable and how fluid the process is. So that's, anytime, I think if you look at any craft or furniture making history or process throughout history, you're going to see it, that there's a close tie to locally available materials. And when you step out of that, you're just adding a lot of complexity. Not that it can't be done or enjoyable, but it just does add a lot of complexity when you're working a craft out of its native habitat. Here's another question. I don't know the actual name, David Cosa. How is your design thinking process? Do you think only in comfort or aesthetics, and is sustainability a part of your process? This really opens up a huge arena that I think by itself would fill a book. But briefly, the design process that I use is pretty organic, and I would call it fairly holistic in that there's not any one thing separated out from it. It's easier to talk about this from the chair standpoint. Tables and desks are a lot simpler. There's more of an aesthetic focus. The structure is a lot easier to address because the demands are not nearly as high as the demands in a chair. But in a chair, I do start every design working over a framework that I know that has the basic lines that ensure comfort and a floor design where, or you know, the way the chair attaches or connects to the floor, that base has to be big enough, and that's a starting point for playing around with that, whatever lines I want to add to create a different feel. My chair designs generally are not client driven. They're things that I just find. They come to me, and when they do, I try to catch them. And I'll catch them by sketching, usually gesture drawings, and they don't have much to do with joinery. They don't have much to do with structure. They will follow my own sense of comfort lines, but initially, the idea is to capture a feeling that I'm feeling when I take a design in, or when an idea comes to me. There's something in there that I want to capture. It's not a specific line. It's not a specific idea. It's not joinery. It's just this vague sense of something. And gesture drawings are for me, a real helpful way of finding my way through that fog. And as I start to refine the form a little bit, then I can make sense of joinery, which is the engineering or structure of the process, the strength of the process, of the piece. But the comfort is something that I was able to capture years ago in a format or a formula that is no longer something I have to search for. It's something that we use the same form in every piece. I think that if you start out a design with a structure, or if you start a design out just with comfort in mind, or at least when that is my process, I more often get stuck. I find myself sort of boxed into a corner that I can't get out of. It's when I let go of everything and just let lines flow and play around with one thing, set it aside, play around with another, and eventually sort of feel my way through to find something that feels like it's going to work. But the most important thing for me, whichever aspect of the design I'm working with at any moment, the most important thing is to keep it as a listening process rather than a thinking process. And by that I mean that creativity is not something that comes from us. It's something that happens in our lives, or it's something that comes to us or through us, but we don't generate it. And if we think we're generating it, we're not going to be allowing really good creativity to happen. So that's the key. Whatever part of it you're trying to, whatever problem with it or whatever aspect of it you're focusing on in any moment, keeping it fluid, keeping it open, and keeping it a listening process are, I think, the key to making something really beautiful and something that feels natural. And every design that I do, I try to make it a natural design. And by that, I mean it's inspired by nature. It is inspired by the tree itself. And every tree is designed structurally, beautifully. The structure, the need for the tree to receive nutrients, all of those things are incorporated in a way that's beautiful. They're not compromising each other. The need for structure doesn't compromise beauty. The need for getting nutrition up the stems don't compromise anything else. So I don't think there's any reason why comfort or strength or aesthetics has to compromise any other aspect of a chair design. I don't think a chair needs to look like a tree, but I think it needs to look naturally like a chair so that everything flows together and works and makes sense. And I think you're more likely to come about a design where all of that does work together if you listen more than think in the process. Archer Yates writes in about a question about high glue, asking which I prefer, tight bond brand, old glue, or granular glue. And this is a really easy one. If you're getting into high glue now and you don't have a lot of experience with it. There's no question Patrick Edwards' Old Brown Glue is the best, hands down. There's no close second. We make our own glue here. I've been using it long enough that we have a pretty good sense of how to manipulate it, adding urea to get a slower set. But without the benefit of having Patrick Edwards' Old Brown Glue and his sense of chemistry working for you, there are a lot of variables and a lot of subtleties with making your own glue out of, or cooking your own granules down and getting everything right. That's something to experiment on the side, but your success rate's gonna be higher with Old Brown Glue. I've been using that for years and trust it completely. Marty Honkakowski, I hope I've done that justice, Honkakowski. In episode one, you said you no longer have much need to prepare prototypes for sit quality of a chair because you have lines, angles, and curves recorded. Apart from jigs and other physical records, how do you store your shapes in digital format for long-term use, and what are the digital tools and digital file formats you play with? How did your tool set evolve over time? This is good stuff. Now I have lines that are sort of preserved in software and printed out on paper. It's a real clear set of geometrical curves, radii, and angles that I work with that are preserved on paper and in digital format. Starting out, those forms were preserved in process. So I would have a bending form for each of the different parts, and I would have a process for putting those pieces together. But it was decades before I was able to identify clearly what the exact shape I ended up with was, or what important angles were there that I needed to preserve. What the chair form as a finished item is pretty different from each of the parts that go into it. It's their overall relationship and joinery that makes it work with your body. So it wasn't, as long as I had the process and the forms, I really didn't need much else. But now I'm doing a lot more experimental work, both in joinery and in chair design. And having a digitally mastered framework for guiding my experiments has been really critical. It's also, now that I've defined that in a language of points in space that form the radii for example, the lumbar and thoracic curves of the back, the angle of the seat, and the safety points on the floor that the chair has to be contacting. I can manipulate one or the other of those if I think I have an idea of how to improve those shapes. So it has been very helpful to reel that in into a two-dimensional visual. I hope that helps. Tinker Trading Company asks, how did you promote yourself when you were starting out, and how would you do it differently if you were starting out today? When I was starting out, I told my neighbor I was making chairs, and that pretty much took care of the first year of production. He happened to be the owner of a small gallery in Berea, Kentucky. The guy's name was Joe Solnick, and that was pretty easy. It also so happened to be that Joe was one of the directors of a local craft show, which made that an easy in for me. And so craft shows were my first marketing, and initially my only marketing work or effort. And this was back in the early 80s when there weren't nearly as many craft shows. The craft shows were not as sophisticated, nor was the work as sophisticated, the work that was shown at those shows. It was much easier to market there because there weren't nearly as many other venues through which people could find fine craft. There were fewer galleries. There were fewer open artist studios around the country. So it was much, much easier times. Today, obviously things are very, very different, and it's a digital world, and so that would be an obvious starting place. And that is where it seems younger artists are starting out their marketing. There are a number of venues like Etsy, and Custom Made is trying to revive their efforts at marketing craft. So those have some success, but I think that if you're going to be making very much and selling much stuff, you're going to have a lot of different ways of letting the world know what you're doing. Even though there are more ways of marketing, I still think the most important thing about getting yourself known is to be doing something that's relevant. And I think that there's a lot of groping and searching, and it seems like sometimes aimless efforts at trying to find oneself place in the world of craft when there's so much going on, and there's a lot of cool stuff going on. But it seems like what's missing, in my view, is a sense of groundedness in one's craft. And that comes from a real mastery. I think that with a sense of mastery in your craft, that takes a lot of time. You got to market yourself in the meantime. But with that, I think it will be easier to relate what you're doing to the people that might be interested in buying it through whatever venue or media you want to market yourself. For me, how we market has a whole lot to do with why we do what we do. And having a clear sense of that, having a clear sense of what your contribution to the craft is, why people should bother buying from you, I think is the most important place to start, so that when you do start talking at a craft show to a potential client, or you do start writing copy for your website, or you do start throwing things up and saying things on Instagram, there's something there that people would be interested in listening to, reading, or seeing. Something that they feel they relate to.
Wood Shavings DS asks, what's the most important thing to nail when building a chair?
He thinks I use nails. What's the most important thing to nail when making a chair? Well, there's three things that have to be successful for a chair to be worth making to start with. If it's a chair, it should be comfortable and worth sitting. It should look good. It should look from across the room like something you would want to go sit in. And once you sit in it, it should hold you up. I think it also needs to be something that is going to be relevant for a long time. If it's going to be worth making on a small scale by hand or with power tools or however you work, it's going to not be a cheap endeavor. So it should be something that's going to last and be relevant for generations. I don't think any one of those things can be taken away and still have something that would be successful. So I can't prioritize that. It's like, which is more important, your lungs or your heart or your brain? You know, you take any one of those away and it's game over. So every detail in any of my pieces supports one or two, and sometimes all three of those. The way I shape the top edge of a slat, the way I carve a pin, exactly how I shape an arm, exactly how I join that arm into the back, all of that really has to support every aspect of what I want to achieve in a design. And if there's a sense that something is being compromised, then I think it's time to reevaluate the design. The only time that I think it's worth doing that is if the economy in which that chair is going to live simply cannot support the level of addressing all of those issues that I like to play with. Fortunately, we're in a pretty good economy right now, so we can have some pretty good fun with design.
Andy Mid asks, how do you feel about using something like domino joinery in chairs? I was thinking to do my first chair project like this.
Okay, domino seems to have taken over the world in joinery, and I can't speak to the quality of joints from that system. I have never used it and probably never will. The primary beef that I have with, regardless of what method you use for floating tenons, and that's what we're talking about with domino, you're plunging in a hole into a piece, there's a way to plunge in another hole, and then you've got a tenon that joins the two. That can be actually a very good way to address a specific type of joinery. When we've got large enough pieces, and it's always in casework or tables, where both parts coming together are large enough to house a tenon and still maintain enough structural integrity to serve the purpose of the piece, then it's an okay way to go. My concern is that there are a lot of woodworkers who are building their design portfolio around that specific kind of joint solution. When you do that, you're going to be building bulkier pieces than you need to, especially if you're doing that with chairs. In chair making, there is a much greater challenge than in case goods to fully integrate the strength from a rail, for example, into a leg. And you cannot do that with a floating tenon. You can't reach the same potential that we reach in our shop with that integration. But I mean, most of our joinery is double tenon joinery milled on, and they have a unique locking taper to both the mortise and the tenon so that they come together with a strength that's was not even possible in traditional joinery. So we're working in a pretty sweet spot in terms of what we can do joinery. And so that certainly impacts my attitude toward a system like domino. If that's the way you're starting, it's going to be really hard to break away from that because it's quick and easy, even though it does greatly limit what your designs can do, and it will make them heavier.
Davison Woodworks asks, Brian, looking into your crystal ball, which trends do you see that really interest you and maybe good trends to pursue?
What trends do I see that interest you? Where is my crystal ball? Did you have it the other day?
It's in the closet.
It's a little dusty to look through at the moment. I don't see what's coming. I see what I want to have coming, and there are bits of hints from clients and visitors that we get about what the opportunities are that probably won't become trends. A huge trend now, for example, obviously is the slab table or slab anything or live edge. I really think that has to do with the degree to which we have become almost divorced from nature, so that we have to go out of our way, or in order to feel connected with nature, we have to have that real raw edge, or we really need something rustic to balance the cold, hard, contemporary aspects of much of what higher tech manufacturing is putting out there, whether it's our watches, our computers, our cars, our houses, or other furniture types that are in the house. But I would hope that there is, I mean, what I dream of is that we can help create a new kind of connoisseurship, I will call it, in furniture. We've seen it happen with wines. We've seen it happen with cigars. It's happening with cigars, guitars, and with cars. You know, people have, in all of those arenas, people have shown an interest in really real good refinement, really good design.
Aldrich asks, how can I direct myself to the right furniture and style of making for me?
I think that starting out now would be exponentially more difficult than starting out when I did. And that is because the number of venues for getting you started with a good sound base are not as many. And I would hold in mind that whatever path you're going to take is going to take a phenomenal amount of passion and commitment to this thing, to this style, to whatever it is you pick up, to be able to get through your growth as a craftsman, and if you become a professional, your professional development and the hard knocks that you'll take along the way. So if you're not feeling a burning passion for it, that's going to be your guide to try something different. I think that's going to be your savior, is listening to what excites you the most. You know, there have been words of wisdom that have been shared to me along my way, and one of them that comes to mind right now that hasn't come to me in a long time, this came from Rudy Asalnik, my landlord in the 80s in Berea. And he was very adamant that you can sell anything. And if you look at the marketplace and the world of stuff out there that is being sold and bought, he's being proven right over and over again. You can flip and sell anything in this world. So if you are passionate about it, that will be what's contagious. And I think that's going to be more important than finding the thing, because if there's a thing out there already, then it's probably the wrong one. There's going to be a new one for you. I think understanding the way things are made and developing your skills and playing around with different things and searching until something really sets you on fire. I would really recommend spending some time with some of the educational institutions like North Bennett Street School or the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, which are two great places to find inspiration, guidance, and education about how to get going in a career like this. So best of luck to you. I hope you'll stay in touch. That wraps it up. So it's been great talking to you guys and gals, and hope to see you again in a couple weeks.